It's time to meet the street with me, David Plimpton. Well, hello friends, and welcome once again to another episode of this, my humble podcast. As per usual, I like to start at the top with a roundup of some of the comings and goings in and around my neighbourhood in the part of the programme I call What I've Been Up To This Week. So, without further ado, let's find out what I've been up to this week.
What I've been up to this week.
Well, it's certainly been a week to remember, because a bombshell has been dropped on Altrincham Avenue. Of course, I'm speaking figuratively because, as we all know, the idea of an incendiary device being deployed on British soil hasn't happened since World War II, and even then those ones didn't quite reach here anyway. Nonetheless, our neighbourhood has been struck by disaster. That's right. This year's literary festival has been cancelled. Now, I was really looking forward to this, not just as a patron, but also because I'd invested quite a sizeable chunk of my own time into this project as a volunteer. So you can imagine my dismay when I received this answer phone message from Festival Chairman Eldred Schaefer on Sunday afternoon.
Hello, David. It's Schaefer. Eldred Schaefer. Chairman of the Literary Festival, yes. Anyway, got some bad news, old boy. Looks like the festival's off. We tried everything within our power to secure a legitimate venue, but sadly the whole thing's gone tits. Interests at an all-time low, Women's Institute are refusing to budge regarding dates for the hall, and to top it all off, Margaret Hartley's been rushed to hospital with suspected elephantiasis of the eyes. Yes. Doctors think she picked it up from that bloody great macaw she keeps. Anyway, all a bit of a storm in a teacup, if you ask me, but there you have it. Looks like we've hit a bit of a dead end, old boy. Now, I'm sure you'll understand, and I thought it best you should know, as you seem to be the go-to man when it comes to all of this social networking hoo-ha. So, be a good chap and notify the rest of the Facebook group, would you, old boy?
No, Octavia, darling, come down from there. You'll get jam all over the napkin rings.
Sorry about that. Having to keep an eye on the grandchildren for the weekend, yes. Tristram and his ghastly new wife are taking the E-type up to the Norfolk Broads, where it looks like Grandad Schaefer's on night watch until we get the nanny back on her feet. Terrible business, that. Anyway, bad news on the literary festival, old boy. Better luck next year, eh? Mustache. Got a rather tasty bottle of Chateau Neuf de Pape staring me in the eye, and it's nearly 1 o'clock. TTFN. Schaefer signing out.
Sad news all round, I think you'll agree. But, in the indomitable spirit of Dunkirk, I'm making a stand. I'm determined not to let that toxic attitude displayed by the Women's Institute, the soul-destroying lack of public interest, and a pair of swollen eyeballs bring me down. And neither should you. Which is why I've single-handedly taken control of the situation and brought it back from the edge by securing an interview with one of Britain's best-loved fiction writers, C.J. Wivel, the mastermind behind one of literature's most recognisable protagonists, schoolboy detective Euripides Jenkins. Now, I'm quite sure you're all familiar with CJ and his wondrous creations, but for those of you out of the loop, here's a short excerpt from his brand new book to get you up to speed.
Euripides Jenkins and the Case of the Turlington Stones. Chapter 1. A storm is brewing. Euripides Jenkins was a curious child, cold on first impression and awkward, both physically and socially, forever uneasy in the presence of others. Indeed, Jenkins was certainly not the type to be found muddied and scrummaging on the playing fields of Shingleton House, nor scrumping for apples in the sprawling orchards of the old Pendletroft farm. Even the mere thought of exchanging pleasantries over a cup of warm plum cordial in the boys' whittling parlour chilled him to the core. For Euripides Jenkins was increasingly akin to activities of a more solitary, bookish nature. Cerebral activities implemented to stretch and mould his cognitive aptitude, even if, in the eyes of his peers, these doings seemed unnatural or outright wrong. For beneath the fragile eggshell exterior, Euripides Jenkins harboured a powerful talent. For this reason, it was an unwritten rule that if Euripides Jenkins was ever to be required for chores or matters of a social nature, the first port of call was always to check under the bed of his half-lit dormitory room. There he was surely to be found, night or day, face down, head buried in the deep shag pile of his prime Axminster rug, breathing deeply through both nostrils, absorbing the rich aroma of his environment, training himself to distinguish every last detail of his territory through the medium of smell and smell alone. For it is said, through his unique ability, Euripides Jenkins could distinguish the minutiae of almost any domain through a simple sniff. You see, Euripides Jenkins was an olfactor of the highest magnitude, an expert sniffer. A skill that through the years had won him the grudging respect of both brutish peers and repugnant schoolmasters alike. Indeed, Jenkins' olfactory senses were in point of fact revered not just amongst the inhabitants of Shingleton House, but in actuality, the length and breadth of the entire kingdom. His sensory prowess discussed by all manner of persons, from the genteel tea houses of Walton-on-Thames to the rough and ready drinking holes of East Kilbride. After all, if it were not for Jenkins' idiosyncratic dexterity, countless crimes and misdemeanors nationwide would have simply been left abandoned and unsolved by even the most accomplished of lawmen. Suspected theft, attempted kidnapping, even murder. And so it passed that on this very day that this particular skill prescribed to Jenkins and Jenkins alone would once again become key in the eternal struggle we call good versus evil. As Detective Chief Inspector John William Tumblety of Scotland Yard stepped off the train at Shingleton Station and began the long, rain-swept trudge to Shingleton House and his appointment with olfactory super sleuth and schoolboy detective Euripides Jenkins.
Thanks very much to our local amateur dramatics group, the Nora Russell Theatre Company, for putting that together for me, as I know they're currently incredibly busy working on a stage adaptation of the 1979 Roy Minton television drama Scum. Anyway, I digress. In this interview, CJ talks about his career and influences as one of Britain's best-loved writers, describes his rags-to-riches journey from humble fudge shop employee to world-renowned author, and he talks openly about his rare genetic disorder known as hyperosmia. So sit back, relax, pour yourself a cup of tea, and join me once again as we meet to the street. CJ Whivell, are you there? Can you hear me, CJ?
Yes, I can. Is that, that's David, is it? David Plimpton?
That's right. CJ, It's a great experience to have you here. For the listeners who are not quite up to speed, could you just tell us who you are and what do you do?
Yes, of course. My name is C.J. Whivell. I'm a fantasy author. I'm responsible for the creation of the schoolboy detective Euripides Jenkins. How to describe him? A Victorian boarding school pupil, gifted with the unique ability to sniff out crime with a powerful sense of smell, which, of course, is something that appeals to young people very, very much, you know, along with hula hooping and scooter board and fizzy pop. So I like to keep abreast of what young people like, and it's a sort of cartoon-like character who has served me very well, and children like that sort of adventure.
Well, I must say these books are indeed the backbone of any avid reader's collection.
Yes, thank you so much. Yes.
And I know many people, children right through to the old and infirm, who thoroughly enjoy these books.
Well, of course, can I just say, you know, I mean, I'd like to take responsibility for, of course, the words of the book very much from my own fevered imagination. But let's not forget the wonderful illustrations by Shane Ritchie. Shane, I asked him to illustrate from very, he'd just been a yellow coat, I think, at the whole seasons. And I said to Shane, would you be willing to illustrate these books. And he was very, very willing. And I think you'll agree, he's done a wonderful job.
It's a really wonderful touch to those books.
Very much so.
Yeah. Back to the programme. Writing is something that, on reading your book, seems to come across incredibly naturally, but it wasn't always in your blood. And you nearly had a very different career path.
Yes, I of course, I wanted, as a young man, I wanted very much to be a stuntman, particularly in westerns, you know, cowboys. Growing up in the 1970s in Leighton Buzzard in Hertfordshire was about as far from Texas as you could get. But I loved the westerns, Ronald Reagan in Cattle Queen of Montana, Gary Cooper in High Noon, Barbara Stanwyck, A Town with No Name, Lee Mitchell's A Horse with No Legs, Jackie Long in Saddle Sore Bandits, and Dick's a Comin'. You know, I love those. But, you know, my father was a shopkeeper, and he said, no, 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 don't be so silly. I mean, a lad from Leighton Buzzard could, you know, just as well get over to Texas and be a stuntman as, have a love affair with Youth of Joyce at the time, you know, which everyone dreamt of, of course. So he said, no, you cannot do that, of course.
And that left you in many ways stranded, as happens to many young boys.
Very much so, yeah.
And you found school an incredible challenge. One of the only subjects that you really mastered seems to have been home economics, which you managed to attain 9 GCSEs in.
Yes, I mean, it's a curious thing. I mean, I was very, very handy with sugar. I was very good. I mean, my plum duff had to be seen to be believed. And I did, once it's a pineapple upside-down cake, which the teacher was so flabbergasted, I won the Rose Award at the local, I went to the local civic centre to collect the Rose Award. My cupcakes were divine. I did a fairy cake that, quite honestly, I mean, if you showed it now to Paul Hollywood, he'd shit himself. Never mind, you know, shaking my hand. He'd throttle me and put him out of a job. I was a wonderful home economist. And at the time, boys didn't do that. I mean, it's hard for young people to realize now. But if you so much as a young man mentioned anything to do with flour or pastry, you'd get a kick in. And that was just from the games teacher. You know, I mean, you'd be lampooned. A friend of mine, Malcolm Sardwell, unfortunately, he made a terrible admission that he'd made a lovely sort of phyllo pastry. And he was run ragged, you know. Puffy Sardwell, they called him, you know, just because he was interested in cake making.
And this is something that's happened to young boys throughout the ages.
They've
mocked for their love of pastry.
Yeah.
But you started to try and forge yourself a career in the world of confectionery.
Now, let's get this right. My father would not have me being a stuntman. He knew that I had these 9 GCSEs in home economics. And a friend of my father's owned... Peter Rowley owned a fudge pantry. And of course, you know, my father said, well, there's an opening for you. Don't forget all this Texas nonsense being a stuntman. I want you to go and work at Rowley's fudge pantry. Of course, when I told my friends and other, you know, adolescents of my age that I was going to work in a fudge pantry, they changed it rather humorlessly to fudge pantry.
Incredibly cruel for these people.
Very cruel. Very cruel. Oh, Wivel's in the fudge panty. Wivel's in the fudge panty. Can we see your fudgy panties, they used to say. And of course, if you want to, you know, make friends with young ladies, that followed you around.
And it must have damaged your morale greatly, trying to forge this career.
Well, it did. I don't remember ever getting any tit. The moment this fudge panties thing went, you know, viral, I had absolutely no chance.
I mean, looking back, it seems almost impossible to make that link from this timid sales assistant who was bullied for having fudge panties to this best-selling author I'm speaking to today. But in many ways, it was the fudge that schooled you in the art of the written word.
Well, yes, it was, only because it was so deathly boring, David. You know, you turn up there every single day. I mean, it's the same recipe every day. Golden caster sugar, double cream, butter, vanilla bean paste. Every day, Mr. Rowley would say to me, come on then, you know, Wivel, come on, get stirring. Get stirring, Wivel, he'd say, get stirring. So I would, every morning, I'd go in there and I would, you know, clockwise with my right arm, I'd be turning, you know, the caster sugar, the double cream, the butter, the vanilla, and I'd be turning and turning and turning with my right arm. It was deathly boring. Of course, in my mind, what was happening was I was making up all sorts of fantasies. But of course, you know, as I stirred and as I spent my entire time thinking about stories, fantasies, what I wanted to do with my life, my right arm got more and more muscly. Can you understand that? Fighting against the butter, the cream, you know, the golden caster sugar, fighting every day. And in the end, my right arm was freakishly muscly, whilst unfortunately my left arm was, well, it was withering. I became known as Withering Wivel, Wivel the Shrivel, and Wivel you Bellend, which didn't rhyme, but was equally, you know, heartless from my contemporaries. Girls wouldn't look at me. And as for being a stuntman for the Westerns, you know, it seemed miles and miles away.
You carried on. You did what you could. And as you mentioned there, you spent many hours stirring the fudge with this incredibly powerful right arm.
Yes, yes.
And it was here you really discovered a love for language, indirectly. The words around you, the text, yeah. The instructions, yeah. The on the fudge.
Yeah. Well, you know, there were very few words around. I mean, the amount of times I read the health and safety poster on the wall about in the event of fire, I could tell it off, you know, go down to Church Street, turn left, and wait for the manager to come and take your name. Copyright, all rights reserved, Rowley's Fudge. You know, I'd be reading this sort of thing all the time. Make sure you turn all the lights off if you're leaving the room. No, limited literary influence there. But nevertheless, it stuck. And it, you know, you see these things over and over and over again. These words take on a significance, you know. I mean, I was all sorts of things. I was reading the instructions on air fresheners in the staff toilet. I was staring at the opening times on the front door, etc. There was one tiny bit of graffiti, which I'm told Jack Bennett, who'd worked there before me, had written. Mr. Rowley is a pro. Now, it allowed my imagination to grow. I had a fevered thought. What did he mean? What did Jack mean? You know. And of course, I had no one to ask. I was just there stirring. Stir, Wivel, stir, I'd say. And on the basis of that, I suggest it was prick.
One of your skills is the ability to take these ideas that run through your mind and turn them into these wonderful stories. But the real eureka moment occurred when a customer came in with a rather fantastic skill. Could you tell us about the moment that Euripides Jenkins was born?
Well, a young customer came in with this uncanny ability to pick out the various flavors of fudge with this extraordinary nasal skill. You know, it gave me the idea of a schoolboy of a similar age to this young man, who could solve crime through his uniquely powerful sense of smell. Now, I never saw that boy again, and I often hope he doesn't, you know, arrive on my doorstep demanding some sort of royalties over the last 30 years. But it was an uncanny ability, and it gave me the germ of an idea.
And that germ, as we know, was the first in your Euripides Jenkins series of books.
That's correct.
Euripides Jenkins in the Case of the Badly Burnt Headmaster.
That's correct, yeah.
Which is an absolutely stunning book. And I remember when that came out, people the length and breadth of the country were tucking into it as if it was a lavish meal. People were reading it on trains, yes. Whilst on holiday. They were, yes, taking it into church services. It was, yes, everywhere, absolutely everywhere.
Yes, sometimes they'd read it at home in various rooms of the house. I saw someone reading it on a train, a bus, as you say. A friend of my wife's was seen reading it in the dry cleaners. It was everywhere.
From my point of view, it sounds like you'd written this book and suddenly, bang, there it was. But in reality, it wasn't as easy as that.
Not a bit of it. Not a bit of it. No, no, no. Look, I tried to convince a number of publishers that, this was the book for their market. You know, the only way I knew, in my rather naive young man's way, was to bombard them.
You persisted constantly at this yes. for many, many months and attempted to try and secure a publisher, but they just would not touch you.
No, no. In the end, what I had to do, I decided to pull a stunt in Leighton Buzzard to draw attention, which I thought, to the plot, the badly burned headmaster. I found a headmaster who was willing for a pound of creamy fudge to pretend to be burnt to a crisp. I had a friend, Jonty Hargreaves, who had a video camera. And sadly, I was distracted by some fudge that had fallen out of my pocket. And this headmaster, I remember his name, Johnson, Brian Johnson, he went up in flames. Now, it resulted in some terrible third-degree burns for the headmaster. And what was worse, no one picked up on the publicity stunt in the press, although Newsroom Southeast did ironically pick up on the fact that Rowley's fudge pantry was going to go bust. You can imagine my predicament. I've burnt a headmaster. I don't have a deal. And you might recall at the time, tiny places like Rowley's fudge pantry were completely consumed by the huge rise in multinational fudge empires that started to dominate Britain's high streets in the mid-1980s. Mm. And suddenly, David, I felt extraordinarily alone in the world. I had no fudge to fall back on or white chocolate, which Rowley's had started to do just prior to going out of business.
You were almost at your wit's end. But then a chance encounter with a rather famous television newscaster with a rather apt name turned everything around in a matter of moments.
Yes. Well, I was very, very lucky. It was both a curse and a blessing. I've started to simply post my manuscript through all the doors in Leighton Buzzard. And to my delight, one of the residents of Leighton Buzzard in Hertfordshire is none other than the ex-BBC television newscaster Gordon Honeycomb. I affectionately refer to him now as Gordon Honeycomb, the sugar caster, because Gordon picked up my book, ran with it. Within days, he had passed it on to his close friends at IPC Publishing, and I was instantly given a book deal. I could not thank Gordon enough. Suddenly, I was the go-to children's author for Japes and Wheezes, and I only had Gordon to thank.
It's wonderful because in some ways you'd gone from a rather drab existence into
yes.
rubbing shoulders with the real stars and
oh, yes.
An almost Hollywood lifestyle.
Yes, I remember we had a lovely party. It was a barbecue party where Jan Leeming came along, Angela Rippon, who at the time you might remember was doing all that Keep Fit stuff. And we were out on the lawn, and I said, "Look, Andrew, would you like to have a read of one of my books, the headmaster manuscript?" And she said, "No, I'm just exercising at the moment." I said, "Well, then you won't want any of my fudge," which she took as a euphemism for something else, and slapped me around the face, and I fell into the pool. It was a rather unfortunate moment. I nearly cracked heads with Lorraine Chase from the Bacardi adverts, who was swimming up and down.
But as you mentioned in other interviews, and you speak quite openly these days, you quite clearly lost touch with reality.
I found myself, of course, appearing quite regularly on some of the top television programs, such as You Bet and This Morning. And I started to get involved with people like, the real stars of the day, Rosemary Connolly and Neil Buchanan. As you say, I lost touch with the real world. But men of my generation don't. We don't go bleating to some counsellor or quack psychotherapist.
Instead of seeking professional help, decided, as many men of your generation do, tried to work out the problems in your own way.
Yes, yes.
And yes. An addiction to microwave meals began
yes. Yes.
that nearly
yes.
destroyed your life.
Well, yes, I mean, I started on the Pop-Tarts, and as these things invariably go, I was having chicken grillers. I don't know whether you recall Bird's Eye chicken grillers, but they're very Moorish. Very, very Moorish. I'd have those Fray Bentos, just add water style chow mein things, which are terrible. But, of course, it's so bloody convenient, isn't it? You stick it in the microwave before you know it, you've got a meal. So I would have those and something which we used to have in the 80s, which was a sort of bacon substitute, breakfast bacon, it used to be called. Now, of course, this is not any good for one. And if one is supplementing one's diet with mountains of fudge and the creamline, the top quality creamline fudge, well, my health suffered enormously. I was practically glowing for the amount of shitty microwave food I had.
You piled on the pounds without...
Yes, standing. I did. Yes, I did.
You became incredibly large. But a severe bout of indigestion gave you a much-needed wake-up call.
Yes, it did. I mean, I thought I was having a cardiac arrest. I discovered that a microwavable Mexican chicken wing had been lodged in my esophagus. And as I belched, this thing flew. It flew across, hit my wife, glanced her on the cheek, and she's got a small scar from this chicken wing. But every time I look into her beautiful green eyes, I see this scar underneath her left eye, and it reminds me of what close shave I had. And to this day, I say to my wonderful wife, Irene, thank you so much. Thank you. That was the wake-up call I needed. And just to look into your eyes, well, just below her eye, just beneath the lower lid, I see this mark from this chicken wing, and it was indeed a wake-up call. You know.
And this awakening you had, it drove you back to writing, and going from an overweight nobody who was obsessed with junk food, you then returned to writing, and in this, amazingly, in the space of a week and a half, you wrote another 5 Euripides Jenkins books. Of those titles, which I'd like to mention here to the people who may not be familiar with the books, course, there was Euripides Jenkins and the Case of the Stovepipe Hat, which was a great success.
Yeah.
Euripides Jenkins and the Case of the Congo Homunculus, which was one of my favorite stories.
Thank you so much, yes.
A tiny Congolese man attempting to murder various people on holiday. Absolutely wonderful story.
Yes, thank you.
Euripides Jenkins in the 7 Cigars of Tutankhamun, which was wonderful book.
Thank you.
Not so well received, Euripides Jenkins and the Massive Football That Killed Everyone, which I thought was more of a sport-themed thriller. But
well,
still,
I rushed it. I rushed that one. I think there was something on television that evening. I know it was the Lady Diana Spencer interview. But for some reason, I just remember, I just finished off. I couldn't decide what to do. And I thought football was very popular. Of course, I didn't really understand what I was doing. We'll draw a discreet veil over that.
And then, of course, the book which in many interviews you've said is the one responsible for burning you out. But yes. I could really see how something as intense as that completely drove you to the edge.
Well, yes. Euripides Jenkins and the Case of the Russian Mafia Hand Under the Pillow.
And that's the one.
It was, of course, the book that was eventually my undoing. It drove me to the edge, and for a long while it made me not want to write a damn thing. The fact is, David, I know nothing about Russia. I know nothing about the Mafia. But it seems that I stumbled upon something which was very nearly my undoing. I had no idea that, the Russians and the ex-KGB and the oligarchs that were coming out of Russia at the time did indeed threaten people by chopping off hands and leaving under their pillows. I had no idea. What was I writing? A simple schoolboy book about a chap who had incredible sense of smell. I had no idea that what I'd done unwittingly was to reveal to the world the methods of the Russian mafia. Almost immediately, I found threats at my front door. A turd pushed through my letterbox. It might have been the local children, but my feeling was that it could well have been one of, well, Putin's henchmen.
It's a very interesting time in your life, and your career really was put on hold because of this fear of the Russians coming in and destroying your livelihood.
Yes.
And it's something that journalists now and biographers have referred to as the wilderness years, where you, although you quite openly speak about it now, for a long time went completely off the radar. You moved to Birmingham, where took up a life on a narrowboat. And I quote this, you refer to this now as a period of complete, as I'm reading a quote here from Wikipedia, a period of complete mental and physical freedom manifested via prolonged periods of nudity whilst expressing your emotions out loud at passers-by through the portholes of the narrowboat. You had to get away, and this was the way that you felt best to ensure that those Russians never came after you.
David, I had no choice. I had no choice. If one is to escape the Russian mafia, one tactic is surely to feign lunacy. I would stand in that narrowboat, pressing my buttocks up against the round portal window, shouting, "Fudge! Fudge!" all day long, in the chance that Putin's henchmen were circling the boat, where they would see, well, a man naked, pushing his buttocks against the window, and his wife, who occasionally, she wasn't that bad, and it would, maybe just remove her dressing gown. And who knows? Who knows? I have tried to ask MI5, but they have assured me that there was literally no connection between me feigning madness and the fact that I wasn't assassinated during that time. But I know different. I think if there's any, and I would like to say to anyone who fears the Russian mafia, if you want to escape, I do still have the narrowboat, and I can verse you very, very well in how to feign madness. Simply remove your trousers and your pants, push your buttocks against the window, and you don't have to shout fudge. You could shout something else. I don't know. And I think that may be enough to ward off the henchmen of the Russian state. I hope so. I just offer that up. Good luck.
You've returned once again to the world of literature, and Euripides Jenkins is back.
He's back, riding the waves once more.
And it's absolutely wonderful to see him back. But outside of this, there's been a massive change in your life, something you couldn't have expected, that bears a terribly amazing resemblance to your character.
Yes.
You woke up 18 months ago, as you normally do, about to carry on with an average day of pressing your buttocks against a window.
Yes, so portal window. Yes.
Fudge through the window.
Fudge and fudge.
When you suddenly noticed your sense of smell had become incredibly powerful.
Yes.
As is the sense of smell of Euripides Jenkins. You at first didn't take any notice of it, and on a visit from the local doctor, you were informed you were suffering from a condition known as hyperosmia, which is a hypersensitive sense of smell.
Yes.
As a fan of your work and as a fan of Euripides Jenkins, I always assumed that the ability to smell from great distances was purely fictional. But you are suffering from this, and it's altered your life in ways you couldn't expect. You have returned to writing because everything else you attempt to do now becomes an incredible chore. Yes. For example, if the average person would wake up on a Monday morning, they would make a cup of tea, they would pop to the shops, they would pop into Ryman's, they may buy a pen, then they would return home.
Some staples or something, yes.
Some staples. You couldn't even face walking through the door of Ryman's because of the stench would be far too powerful.
Rubber bands. The stench in Ryman's of rubber bands. And I could even pick out the Tippex. My sense of smell is extraordinary. I'm going to say something to you now, which you will find absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
You had watercress with an egg sandwich today, and I'm just, hold on. 121, you had it. Would that be correct?
That is absolutely amazing.
Not mustard cress, watercress is what you had today.
That's exactly what I had for my meal. People listening may not believe what we're saying is accurate. I know many of your fans have said that this story of you.
It's a publicity stunt. Yes, indeed.
And I feel that this is one of the only ways that we can really clear this up. You've just observed the smell of my mouth over the microphone.
Yeah. Your mouth is enveloping me. Absolutely enveloping me now. Yes.
I'm breathing onto the microphone now.
That is a little bit too much. That's actually making me bilious.
That clearly won't happen again. I'm sorry for breathing too heavily. As you mentioned previously, writing has been one of the things that's helped you through this tumultuous time in your life, being unable to leave the house to mingle with people such as Neil Buchanan or just family friends.
Yes.
Is there a cure available? Is there a way that you think you could go on? Or is this the end?
I feel that I've been rather unjustly dealt with. I feel that, as you said, people do think it is a publicity stunt, but it's very, very real. It's very, very real. For a while, I suspected it was COVID in reverse, that where most people can't smell anything, I can smell every last damn thing. I feel that unless there is a cure fairly soon, I am going to be driven mad. That is how sensitive my nose is. I feel I won't be able to go on much longer, and I feel that in many ways it's a blessing, because Euripides has hung round my neck like a cheap piece of jewellery from Rattans or Elizabeth Duke at Argos. And perhaps it is time, and maybe Euripides himself somewhere in the hinterland of my creativity is saying enough is enough. And it's time to move on. And I have no doubt, David, the moment I say no more Euripides, my smell will return to normal.
Will we see the death of Euripides Jenkins?
I might leave it hanging. I might leave it hanging open. I feel that if the gods of creativity are looking down at me, and I've been so cruel to play this trick on me, the least I can do is now write a long-standing plan of mine about a topless model, and hopefully my bosoms will grow every bit as large as my smell has increased. That is my plan. If you see me a year from now at the Hay Literary Festival with an enormous pair of knockers on the stage discussing my book about Melinda Messenger, Sam Fox, Debbie Corrigan, you'll know that the gods of creativity have been smiling down on me. Bosoms. Bosoms of the future.
Well, CJ, I must say that the gods of pleasure have been smiling down on me today for allowing you speaking with me. It's been absolutely wonderful. There's no doubt in my mind that I will be buying the latest book, Euripides Jenkins and the Case of the Turlington Stones.
Wonderful.
Could you give us a release date for the book? When would it be available for the public to pop in?
Well,
to buy?
Unfortunately, I've missed the Christmas market for this year. But I'm very much hoping that it will hit the Easter market, where I'm planning to offer Euripides Jenkins in this new book as a hardback, plus a free fudge Easter egg.
Well, CJ Wivel, I must say I will be first in the queue for that book and Easter egg combination. It's been absolutely wonderful speaking to you today. And all I can say is that if you ever are passing by, I would love to repay you for this as a way of thanks by inviting you into my house and allowing you full use of the downstairs toilet, which my wife Jill believes is unhygienic if used by anyone else other than us. That's as a way of thank you for taking part in today's interview.
Terribly kind of you. I would like to send you my new manuscript, but unfortunately, I'm a little bit too mean for that. I will send you a bookmark, which is not so much a bookmark. It's not leather. It's a piece of paper that I tore out of the Daily Express. But you can have that.
CJ, that really is incredible. I was not expecting
my pleasure. My pleasure.
I can only say in return, if you do choose surgery to try and cure yourself of your hyperosmia, I'm willing to offer you the lining of my own nasal cavity, if needed, as a way of saying thank you for not just taking part in today's interview, but also offering me a piece of torn newspaper.
Is very kind of you. And if you were to offer me the sensitive lining of your nasal cavity in return for the slither of paper from the Daily Express from 2 or 3 years ago, I believe, I think it's a little bit of the crossword and back page and a bit of sport, which I don't read anyway, I would be willing to give you, I've got it just down here, one of my watercolours that my wife painted of me on the canal. Well, you say it's me, you don't know it's me, but it's my buttocks pushed up against the porthole window. And she's entitled it, let's just have a look on the back, CJ's Buttocks, which she's written with one T. She's illiterate. Quite a good painter, but illiterate.
CJ, I really am almost moved to tears here. That's probably the nicest thing anybody's ever done for me. I really don't know how to repay you. All I can say is that to receive a piece of art like that is wonderful. I have no artistic skills myself, but I'm fully willing to take a photograph of myself in the bath and have it enlarged at Boots, the chemist, into a, I believe it's an A1 size poster, and have that sent to you, that you may put that up on your wall to see
If I were to send you this slither of the Daily Express in return for your nasal cavity, in return for the picture of my buttocks, and then a photograph, as you say, reproduced at Boots, the chemist, in actually one of their machines that they have there, for me, for my use, to hang in my living quarters, I would willingly, what else have I got down here, give you one of these, which is one of my slippers with, it's got a leather upper, it's seen better days, and it does have some dog saliva on it just there, which I'd be willing to wipe off and send to you via a courier. That would be my pleasure.
I am truly touched and blessed to know that you would offer me this, and I really can offer you nothing else other than potentially kidnapping someone and sending them to you as a slave, which may be slightly technical because I'm relatively old now and probably not physically strong enough to kidnap someone and send them to you. Alternately, I could try and befriend a scientist. We could try and create a test tube baby that I could grow into slavery and send to you as a personal slave. It's all I can do to say thank you.
Well, if you were to send me a slave or grow one from a test tube to me for my personal use in return for the dog slipper, the porthole bottom portrait, and the slither of Daily Express as a bookmark, I would happily give you, we've got one piece of chicken satay in the fridge. There is some peanut sauce that you can have with it. I'll ask my wife if she can put it in a Tupperware, and I'd be perfectly willing to send that to you by first post tomorrow morning when the post office opens.
CJ Wivell, you are a wonderful man. My table is set. I await the meal. Once again, I thank you for taking part in this interview. I love you very much in a physical and mental way. It's up to you which one you wish to receive if we are ever to meet. I thank you very much, and goodbye.
I thank you in return and give you a big kiss on your lips when I was pretending to go for your cheek, and at the last minute, the corner of my mouth just touch the edge of yours, and maybe, even if there was time in the subterfuge, to slip my tongue in the side of my mouth so it touched your lip. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this episode of Meet the Street, remember to like and subscribe on iTunes or your favourite podcast provider. Follow me on Twitter at PlimptonDavid and join my Facebook page at MeetTheStreet1. And if you're really feeling generous, you can donate a small fee via ko-fi.com/MeetTheStreet. Every penny helps. Until next time, goodbye.
Jill, I've done it. You can use the spare room for the washing now.